Hello, I'm Lori Hennessy, and I'm the CEO of League of Education Voters. Welcome to the first episode of our brand new podcast, Washington Game Changers. I'm going to introduce my guest in a moment, but first, I wanted to introduce you to this new podcast. In case you're not familiar with us, League of Education Voters is a statewide nonprofit working with families, educators, and leaders to build a brighter future for every Washington student. We do that through field and community engagement, research and policy, advocacy, and more, building a coalition to make a long and lasting impact. We believe that education is a tool for justice. We believe every child deserves an excellent public education that provides an equal opportunity for success. Now, a word about me. I came to the League after a long career in politics, nonprofits, communications, and community engagement. My passion is kids, particularly those who are not well served by our systems, our government, and our schools. In the last year, fatigue and exhaustion have been great, yet there's still so much to do. So I want to do what I can to provide a forum for those who are doing amazing work, inspirational work, work done with care and passion and bravery. I want to talk to them and hear their stories and then share them with you. Washington Game Changers will look at innovative solutions to our problems of today, inspire others, and lead the way in making Washington State more equitable and just. This podcast, quite simply, is a one-on-one conversation with powerful leaders in a time when we need to hear about the good people doing good in this world. And that brings us to my first guest. For me, there really was no question who it would be. Dr. Ben Danielson is a 1992 graduate of the UW School of Medicine, a pediatrician, and he led the Odessa Brown Children's Clinic in Seattle for more than 20 years. He's also a professor of clinical pediatrics. He's been on multiple boards, volunteers relentlessly, and has cared deeply about his patients, their families, and our community. Dr. Ben spoke at our annual event this fall on racial equity in education. Many of you joined us watching this wonderful event, and you can still find the recording on our website. He's had quite a journey since then, so I wanted to check in with him. This year has been a time for a lot of soul searching for many of us since the murder of George Floyd. We've been engaged in long overdue reckoning over racism, both in our country and in our own lives. So there's a lot to talk about. And I know it's a lot more than one conversation, but now felt like a really good time to start. Dr. Ben, welcome.
Thank you. And I just want to say thank you for all that you do for kids and for education. I really admire the organization and the personal mission that you have in really looking out for, especially the kids who are least well served.
Thank you. Thank you for everything you do. So first of all, thanks for coming back and joining us. And tell me a little bit, if you could, about your own lived experience. Where did you grow up and what brought you into medicine?
The pre-Seattle time. I was born on the East Coast, and pretty early on as a toddler, I was placed in foster care. And then very luckily, I was fortunately rescued from that by this single hippie mom, Jude, who raised me along with her two children, her two daughters. So single mom and two sisters. She moved us to D.C., inner city D.C., I think partly because my mom and my sisters are white and they wanted to make sure I had the opportunity to be in an environment and context that spoke to me as a Black person, and that I had people that looked like me around me, and maybe provided some of the lessons and experiences that she knew that she might not be able to do. So I lived there and spent a lot of time in neighborhoods, learning from Black elders, people I would call my street moms, like Big Mama Pearl and others who taught me some of the lessons that I know a lot of other folks get taught, especially BIPOC folks, around the twice as good lessons and lectures and how to avoid coming into the direct and most risky kinds of situations with people in authority. I didn't always listen, but when I was heading towards high school, my Mom decided it was time for her to pursue her own dreams. I was getting in trouble a lot in DC, and she was looking for her next life, her next chapter. She always wanted to be a forester, work for the Forest Service. So, without an actual job, without necessarily anything solid, she moved us out to Hamilton, Montana, a small town in western Montana, and we started a different life there. I had gone from being in a school where my two sisters were two of the few white students in that school to being in a high school where I was the first and only black student in that high school. And lots of interesting experiences in between there with some of the naive kind of lack of understanding about cultural differences, at least between black and white. Some of the odd questions about hair and muscles and things like that, and also good people who created strong friendships. I went to college back east after high school, and then when I was looking for medical schools, I looked around and first of all, I saw Seattle, the space that has this intersection of urban culture and outdoor extravagant possibility. Not that I'm much of an outdoorsy person. I might get kicked out of Seattle because I don't camp, hike, kayak, or have anything strapped to the roof of my car. And but I love the city and the vista of it and the vibe, which seemed pretty relaxed and interesting. And then the medical school, which was one of the top rated in the country for research. Was also one of the top rated in the country for primary care preparation, was top rated for sending doctors out to developing countries and to do work all over the globe and to work at the CDC and do all these amazing things. So I figured I was going to get a good education from that experience.
So before we go to the next part of your career, you said something in passing just now. You said twice as good. And it's interesting because I know what you're referring to. And as you say it, I realize I don't know if everyone knows what you're referring to when you just, just refer to you are very aware of twice as good and that I think Mama Pearl, you said, had taught you some of that. Tell me more about twice as good.
Yeah, Big Mama Pearl. I'm assuming that the twice as good speech is a little bit different for different people, but in the black community in particular and other BIPOC communities, there are lessons that need to be told, or at least that elders feel like they need to tell young people as they're starting to become more parts of communities and society. The twice as good speech for me was something along the lines of this country is not designed in your favor. You are a black man who's going to try to make it in a world where odds are stacked, and yet you have to succeed anyway. You have to try. You have to work. And not only do you have to work, but you have to work twice as hard as someone who's not black. You have to speak twice as well as someone who's not black. You have to strive to do twice as much achievement sometimes to get just the same amount of success or recognition. And that the twice as good spoke to a way of behavior, perhaps, in addition to the sort of running a race with some ankle weights on. And I don't think I've really run into a black child raised in a black community that hasn't had that speech. And there's one other piece to that, if I could. There was a moment, I think, when both Big Mama Pearl and Hippie Jude kind of realized something that I hadn't didn't quite see yet. I can't tell you exactly the age, but it was almost like it was a light switch moment from off to on. And I went from being, I think, frequently commented on as such a cute kid, cute boy, and I was not cute. I had a big nappy afro and skinny legs and arms, but commented in that sort of adorable way to people looking at me with more fear. And I think that was when Big Mama Pearl knew that she had to give me that speech. I think Black young people, in fact, I know that young BIPOC people are maturized in the eyes of other people at an earlier age. It's part of what leads to disparate rates in incarceration and police shootings and other things about not understanding development or age across races.
Yeah. Tell me about children's, both what drew you to it a little bit. You were telling me the other day about some wonderful history that I didn't know about children's, and so both sides, what drew you to it and why you left.
History is our present, right? We are what we are. The spaces around us are what they are, as an accumulation of history. So I pay attention to history and as much as I can. The history of Seattle Children's Hospital is really powerful. It was started by these amazing strong women who decided that the Northwest needed a source of care for their young, precious children. As Seattle was really beginning to evolve as a city, this was over 100 years ago. In addition, the communities were starting to aggregate and form in different ways. And so the interesting piece to me was this hospital was started by women, and it created this set of values that are much deeper and stronger about how you regard fellow human beings. And apologies to others with Y chromosomes like me, but I think that the deeper thinking about the foundations of things, the strength to lift and carry and build things, historically those have come much more from women than from men. And there's just an incredible power of womanhood that has done most of the good in the world, I think. The Seattle Children's women were white women who were part of higher society. They met with this other group of women, these Black women from a support group called the Dorcas Society that was supporting the Black community. And these Black women came to them and I think knew they could speak to other women and say, "We have children who need care. Our community is poor. We don't know if we're welcome in a place like Seattle Children's, and we want to know if our kids with tuberculosis and needing surgeries and having chronic diseases can get care there." And after these women spoke, the mission statement for Seattle Children's very early on, and in second or third year or something, was the dedication to care for all kids, regardless of race, religion, creed, or ability to pay. Which I think is an act of activism, is a powerful act for that time. I doubt that other organizations or institutions had anything near that kind of a robust, inclusive kind of policy. And I think it's powerful. And I think it is also when you make a big promise, you have to hold to it. And so I think it's one that I also personally hold Seattle Children's to, regardless of what year it is.
So you were there for 20 years as part of Odessa Brown.
Yeah, went through residency, and believe me, I have every goofy badge picture from every era of my professional life. Finished residency, kept working at Children's in different ways, and then in 1999, was fortunate enough to get my dream job of the medical director at the Odessa Brown Children's Clinic, that also has a history that is also about women. A clinic that arose out of the civil rights era as a statement from a Black community. Central area that back then was 75% Black, that said, "We want healthcare our own way. We want a place that is in our neighborhood, that is staffed by us, that kids see themselves when they walk through the door, that has a special regard for the not only the quality of care that everyone deserves, but also the dignity that is not always automatic in the way systems serve people." Started by women. That's the reason our clinic is named after a woman, Odessa Brown, another activist your mom would be proud of. Its first medical director was Blanche Levizzo, quiet, more reserved activist. Grew up and went to school with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Atlanta. And I'm pretty sure she taught him every one of his good lines and words. Over the time, I've been able to be a present. But the history, the strength, and the energy of Odessa Brown Clinic is really about women.
a lot of us spend our lifetimes looking for work that fulfills us. And, you know, there's that old quote about how do something that you love and you'll never work another day in your life. And just from the little time that I've spent talking to you, the alignment between your passion in what you care about in terms of community-centered care and the people who live around the clinic, your own passion around equity and then healthcare, everything aligns. So it takes a lot to leave that. So tell us about why you don't want to be there anymore.
Well, I'll amend your first statement. do what you love, and you will work with your heart in it for every day of your
life. Thank you. That's,
and
yes.
Look forward to going to work every morning of your life.
Yeah. Much better.
Work, right? Like, yeah. Like family or anything else. It's the work that you want to do, you care to do, and you have the privilege of doing. And the families I've gotten to know, the lessons I've learned, it's very strange to get paid to do a job that you would just adore and pay to do and to learn more from the people that you're supposed to be helping. So there's a lot of selfishness that goes into it. And to see generations of young people grow into their possibility is one of the most profound honors you can have. You know that. You're an educator.
But you, so what made you not want to be part of it anymore?
Coming to moments when you really have to ask yourself important questions, not that you haven't asked them before, but that the accumulation of the answer is really presenting itself in the way that you must respond in a different way. Mm. It's not often one moment or one thing that makes for a big pivot, a big change in your life. It is, I think, the power of reflection, though, that is part of that. And so for me, there were a series of events that stretch back a decade. And their being in the past doesn't make them any better. You know, smarter people than me have said, it's always the right time to do the right thing. Yeah. The best time to plant a tree was yesterday, and the next best is today. The idea that there are signs, messages, behaviors, trends in a system that you already know is designed to create the risk of harm to people of color, to BIPOC folks. But then to see the manifestation of that harm in avoidable ways, avoidable structural racism. I don't know if there's a school of thought around that, but you just made me want to kind of explore that more. All of it should be avoidable. Some of it is more presciently and in the moment, presently avoidable. Mm-hmm. And I was seeing a disregard for trying to avoid harm over time and in worsening ways. Selfishly, I also started to experience more and more sort of being pushed to the side, taken out of spaces of decision-making and authority, set in a space where I was felt less regarded, less welcome by the organization. But more importantly, to be honest, it was really what I was seeing happening both to other people and staff and the way it was affecting communities. I can be specific if you want. But that's sort of the context. There was added to that some really final blows, not last straws, but last logs, like big, in addition. And then this very intentional self-reflection, this, if I am buying into the idea of a time of reckoning, I should start with the person I see in the mirror every morning, really understand myself in that space. And it became very clear to me pretty without too much thought that my presence was actually contributing, was complicit in standing up an institution that was adding harm in an intense way to the community that I was calling out as deserving of different care. I realized that stayed in an organization that treated me poorly, and I don't know, Big Mama Pearl probably made me too proud of that. But, if you allow yourself to be in a situation that is treating you poorly, then there's a piece of your own completely to blame for that. I watched people who were profane in their language and their behavior, be elevated as diversity champions. And I watched people who were profound in their expressions of social justice and the need for us to have a different kind of stance in both personally and organizationally in order to serve children better. Those people were fired and silenced and pushed aside or threatened if they spoke too loudly. I don't think anyone would argue that that's the kind of environment that we should aspire to support with our presence, or wait for another day when things might change if something turned a corner. No, this is a reckoning for each of us. We have to stand. We have to stand and make the choices that are probably the hardest choices of our lives. Leaving the clinic, hardest choice possible for me professionally. Separating from these wonderful people in the clinic and so many great people at the hospital as well. Separating from families that deserve, it just lifted me up in addition to just being wonderful inspirations for the world. And making that choice was very hard. Practically, it was hard too. In order for me to speak to you today, honestly, I had to leave without a severance, because with severances come non-disclosure agreements and other things.
Strings.
Yeah. And I had to do that without another job prospect at the time, without quite knowing. Maybe it was a little bit like Hippie Jude moving to Montana without knowing what it is. But,
But you are now connected to UW.
yeah, starting to build something there that I hope has the potential for some really meaningful work with the BIPOC communities and some of the people who've been most harmed by our systems. And I will feel great for the privilege to do that work, and I hope it'll be wonderful work, and I hope I'll wake up looking forward to it every day. And it will never ever be like working at the Odessa Brown Children's Clinic.
You and I talked the other day about this whole sort of strange development the last few years, where there was almost like a this huge robust fan club in town growing up around you're going to get all embarrassed, but this is true. Speaking as someone in the nonprofit setting, I think I've heard you speak at five or six different events every time, and this is before going through some of my very own overdue soul searching. It still was very, very effective. Just personally, professionally, you were always surrounded by people who were all, Dr. Ben, Dr. Ben. And there was this one talk I think I mentioned to you where I saw the human being in you that was struggling with this feeling of taking on this role. And was it a feeling of being a token that Children's would have you out there speaking? And now, since I've got to know you a little bit, imagining you going through some of the things behind the scenes while we all were flocking to hear you speak, it's just a very interesting feeling that must have been for you.
For all of us, right? Because it sounds like you had a response to that as well. Interactions are shared, relationships are shared, and there's a dynamic set of responses that we have across those interactions. So I'm assuming that in some ways it created some thoughts for you as well.
Yeah, definitely. What about our systems? I mean, our systems we're all grappling with. I mean, it's everything from inherited wealth to redlining, no access to capital, and of course, where we are in education. And COVID-19 has just laid bare everything, right? I mean, now everything has been seen even more starkly. So I imagine that in your role, you were seeing that for the last year, both in terms of health impacts and also just kids not being able to access education as they needed.
COVID-19 has been the great revealer of the things that we already knew and could
Mm-hmm.
see if we really looked. So I hesitate in giving this last year
Yeah.
some like new knowledge or new information, because I just think it just put a highlighter pen and a magnifying glass and bold and italics and underlining it around what we already knew and saw all the time. The diminishing family wealth in the Black community in Seattle is a trend line that you can see over 50 years going down. The home ownership rates when Odessa Brown Clinic started were for Blacks in Seattle were higher than they are today. The issues in education during COVID, I think, must make us ask ourselves really serious questions about how do we make hard decisions in hard times that do not propagate or increase disparity, that aren't worsening racism and oppression across many lines of poverty, of different forms of how people identify, and different forms of how people are identified by those around them? We are causing right now a problem, particularly in education, but also I think in health and other parts of our society, that I know we're going to feel terrible about what we've done when we measure and see this, not
No.
generation from now, not a decade from now, but like a year from now, 2 years from now. What do we need to do differently right this moment, particularly if we're talking about this being a reckoning? To stop that process, not only stop the harms that we see happening systemically and structurally, but also stop the harms that we project to occur because we are not changing things today. I just wonder what our own reckoning is around that.
You gave a talk for Martin Luther King holiday, and I talked to you the other day, and we were like, let's not call it a holiday. I think you said called it a day on. And you gave a talk which really was wonderful, and I will share that link in our follow-up to people, but an amazing talk. One of the things that you said that was really profound in there was this idea around fatigue, and people saying that they're just tired right now. And I guess two things for you, the fatigue that people are feeling and must fight, but then also this feeling of the well-intended moderate people, the progressives who mean well. So on both of those points, i.e. the fatigue and also the well-intended people, I mean, what do you say about that right now in this moment?
I can Nothing new from me. I can only echo the statements that I think are just a truth that we have to examine right now. The words that the Reverend Doctor said about the power of the moderate to do harm is actually greater than the power of the extremist to do harm in our society. The moderate who is complacent, or the moderate that says that justice is inconvenient right now because I'm tired or because something else is going on, that is a much greater harm and will cause greater harm than any bloviating, lying, misogynistic, racist president ever could. I stand by that. I say that, and I would challenge people to think about that. I guess I would also say that weariness is a truth, and there are ways in which people tap into weariness that they haven't before. There are many communities, BIPOC and other, that have struggled, have faced oppression, and have know the sense of weariness that other people are feeling, and maybe know it even better, more deeply. And I think we should at least think about that. The second thing I would say is, and I say this from my own personal experience, that when you are weary for the reasons that we are re weary right now, which are both the economic and stress of uncertainty and the ways in which our lives have changed, but also the questions that we must be asking about the way this pandemic has made us see how fragile some components of our infrastructure our society are. The cure to that weariness coming from a doctor is activism. The action that you take to be true to your values, I promise you, will make you feel like you have an energy that you hadn't known ever before.
What about kids? I keep thinking about kids right now. The kids in terms of those who might have been accepted already into college, who had to say, "No, I can't because I'm helping with my family now." Those who are getting school online on their mom's phone on a hotspot. I mean, we just hear stories all the time about how kids are experiencing this time differently. And I know we touched on this a little bit about the pandemic sort of highlighting what already exists, but you know, we've been talking for so long about making schools more equitable and about finding more equity for students everywhere. And I assume that you experienced that so much in the community. I mean, what are some things we can start doing? And I know there's so much to do. It feels like activism is a big part of it, doing something rather than just talking about it.
I think there's a few ways for us to think about this, and I'm just going to lay out a couple of bigger
Yeah.
picture ideas. I believe we have a society that has the access to so much resource that nobody should need to suffer. And when I say that, what I mean is we will all be better when we redistribute resources in a way that makes sure that everyone has opportunity to be better. And until we do that, we're not going to be well. We're not going to be well as a society. We have data that says places with greater wealth gaps make everyone, including the wealthy, sicker. We know in our hearts that part of the design of this society is to make sure resources go to people who need it most or who deserve it most. So that makes me think, right? What are the things that make for privileged youth more able to navigate this time successfully than others? And those are the resources that should be shifted very directly, very quickly, and very thoroughly to places where those resources don't exist. Second question, we are, I think, accumulating a debt that we owe to those young people for whom their opportunity has been curtailed. How do we make sure that even if there are things that are happening right now that are affecting their opportunity, what do we structure in the near future to start paying down that debt that we owe to those young people? How do we superstructure the environment in a post-pandemic moment or something that especially invests in those who have been most affected? That is actually the definition of equity. And if we are in a time when we love to talk about equity, that is exactly what equity says. That actually means that that we would do things that some people would call unequal and even sometimes unfair, because you're going to fairly and justly invest in folks who had previously been unfairly divested in. We can make the plans for that today. Even if we can't enact everything we want to, we can make the plans to reinvest in those communities and those kids today. I think that first and foremost, if you go to the communities that have been most sidelined and most disenfranchised by this current situation, they will have all the best ideas for what we should do to support them. And I can sit here and throw stuff out there, and I would hope a lot of people would say, forget that. I want to go talk to the source. I want to go talk to the people with the most lived right now, raising kids during this time.
So one more question. When you and I talked early when we were planning our event, there was this moment that I'm now always going to joke about when I see you, when we were brainstorming what to do in our breakout sessions after this event you helped us with. And I said, maybe we can have every person say three things I'll start doing tomorrow. And I vividly recall you said, I think you said, I say this with the kindest intent, but that's a very white thing to say. And on my own journey, I'm finding that as a lifelong do-gooding Northwesterner, I'm always in search of closure. I'm always in search of feeling good about myself. How do we combat that right now? Because this is not a quick journey. This is not three things to do tomorrow.
One answer is start. Don't decline doing something because you're waiting for the right three things to show up for you. So I think starting is really important, probably for any journey. It's really hard for them to happen if you don't start them. I think that this commitment to an evolving iteration and pathway, it is very white to think that there's a linearness to all of this as well. And you assume linearness when you say there are three or five steps. I think most other world communities see parallelness and branching patterns and fractals and ways in which you find several ways to solve rather than one way to solve. Because when you have one way to solve, it's sort of like having one story, and anyone who doesn't have the luck to make that one solution work for them is then suddenly considered a, like failing or something, which is really ridiculous. I think that just to make you feel better, I won't name anything, but I was talking earlier today with a group of people, wonderful people, every one of them, and there were several BIPOC folks in this conversation, and then a few white folks. And I did this sort of talk, and I included some things like these five forms of deferring equity, the way equity can be deferred, by making it look like you're doing equity work when you're not, or making equity unaccountable, and all these, I have these, these things, and then a whole lot of other things. And at the end, it was really the one white person who said, "Wow, thank you for those tangible steps, because that was the most important thing to me." And it was really different than the emotional conversation and different parts that were happening. And this is a, I think there's a good way during a time of reflection in the beginning of a year that's part of a reckoning to look at many structures and ask, is that really the way it has to be? Is it really that when somebody writes down something, it suddenly takes more importance for me than when they say it orally? Does it really have to be that when people need things to have a beginning and a middle and an end, and that closure has to happen, or else the rest of it didn't matter as much? Does it really have to be that way? What can we ask ourselves about things that feel like they're inherently important that might just have been created by folks who had one set of perspectives?
My last thing, the vase. Your metaphor from the poem, if you could share that, it just really has stuck with me.
Again, I think anything I've said is borrowed, stolen, taken from others. And this poet Walcott had these two lines of poetry, and I won't be accurate, but it was something like, "Break a vase, and the love that goes into reconstructing its fragments is much stronger than the love that took its symmetry for granted when it was whole." And I think that speaks to this time in such an important way. This is a fragmenting time. It is inherently broken vase time. And I think it's important from a hope perspective to know that what we build out of this might actually be much, much greater, much more beautiful than the times in which we assumed that we would drive to work and gather and do all the things that we just made part of our regular daily schedules before we had this time before us. I also think it tells us in the future not to be afraid to break things in the name of improving things. We have foundations that are rife with racism and oppression and bias, and many people suffer from that. Many people suffer at the hands of that. Let's break that out and construct things that are based on the foundations of equity and love and co-destiny, that we're all part of the same fabric. Let's build those things. I like those things. Then we won't have to work so hard to undo the challenges and the brokenness of the systems that are doing exactly what they're designed to do. which is to oppress many people.
So in your new job, are you going to still be in the community? Will you still be able to, will I be able to hear you speak?
I worked hard to be able to stay in the community. Children's worked hard to try to prevent that for a while, in my view. There were days when it felt really tempting to want to just, let me go somewhere and start over, and like just a fresh beginning. And then at this rising level of support from so many people in so many parts of this community is such an amazing, humbling, overwhelming, overexposing, amazing kind of thing. I said amazing twice. And it also reminded me both that there is so much work that we need to do together to build the foundations, to break the vase and reconstruct it in a beautiful way. There's so much beautiful disruption that we need to do together. Mm-hmm. And what I heard from people was that I owe them a rededication to that work. I owe them that they standing for me, with me, beside me in this time. And I owe this community, broader communities that I love, a rededication to doing good work, to understanding my complicity, knowing that I might not always escape that, being aware as much as possible when I am in those spaces, and see and try to make happen the kind of future that you and I see when we look into the eyes of young people.
Thank you. That was very, very helpful. Thanks again. And congratulations on the UW connection. I will be following you at your speaking events. So thanks again.
Thank you for everything you do. And good luck with this podcast. Thank you for letting me be case 1A.
And we won't go into the audience how many times I had to work on the technology. So thank you for your patience.
This is a one take wonder. It's fine.
Yeah, right.
Whatever came out of it, came out of it.
All right. Thanks again.
Thank you. It's good to see you.
So that's it, our first Washington Game Changers podcast. And on our next one, we'll be talking to Marty Hartman, the executive director of Mary's Place in Seattle, an organization that provides safe, inclusive shelter services for women, children, and families on their journey out of homelessness, and an organization near and dear to my heart. So I hope you watch for that, and we'll be keeping you posted. If you have additional questions or comments, send them to me. It's laurie@educationvoters.org. L-A-U-R-I at educationvoters.org. A recording of today's presentation will be on our website, educationvoters.org. And if you know of someone changing our community for good, send them my way. Thanks again for attending, and together we will fight for a world in which true educational and economic equity exist. Thanks again, Dr. Ben.
Thank you.